What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Hi there, I'm Zach Braff.
And I'm Donald Faison.
We're real life best friends, but we met playing fake life best friends, Turk and JD, on the sitcom Scrubs.
20 years later, we've decided to rewatch the series one episode at a time and put our memories into a podcast you can listen to at home.
We're going
to
get all our special guest friends like Sarah Chalk, John C. McGinley, Neil Flynn, Judy Reyes.
Show creator Bill Lawrence, editors, writers, and even prop masters will tell us about what inspired the series and how we became a family.
You can listen to the podcast Fake Doctors, Real Friends with Zach and Donald on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Hello, everybody. How are you doing this afternoon, evening, morning, whenever you're listening to this fine podcast coming into your ears? Hopefully, you're sticking around from last week's episode. Holy crap. I knew it was going to be a popular episode when we had Pat Flynn from Have Heart Fiddlehead on. But wow, a lot of people just dove into this show and were like, man, I never even heard of this podcast. Thanks for doing this. So if you're joining us again for another week, thank you very much. Tell some friends. Pass the word around. This is not a secret, you know? This should be for everybody. Anyways, I'm Ray Harkins. I'm your host. I am here talking to people who are involved in independent music, who contribute to it in a meaningful way, who have been affected by it in a meaningful way. And those are two funnels that I fall into. I've contributed to it by doing this podcast and doing a bunch of other dumb stuff in music. But then I just love this stuff so much. Like, I recently got a windbreaker hoodie, and then I also, or no, no a windbreaker, a camo windbreaker, and I also got a new record from a demo that I absolutely love. This band called Inclination, from Kentucky, straight edge hardcore band, does it right. And the camo zip up that I got, windbreaker, was from Cabal 315, a great, awesome clothing company done by hardcore dudes, all out of the Syracuse hardcore scene. But anyways, I got these things and I was like, this reminds me of what it's like to be 15 years old ordering from the Victory Records catalog in like 1996. You know, I so distinctly remember for Christmas one year, I went to my mom and I was like, Mom, rather than you going around and, you know, shopping and trying to figure out stuff that I'm into, could I just order a bunch of this stuff, this merch and CDs and whatever from this record label catalog. And she was like, oh yeah, go for it. So here I am at Christmas time opening up like Earth Crisis hoodies in front of my grandparents. And they're like, oh, cool that you got this. But anyways, I just love music. Okay. And I'm glad you do too. Who do we have this week? We have Lex Marshall from Daughters. He is the vocalist. And, he is such a cool dude, such a sweetheart. And, I only had like a limited exposure to him, which you'll hear me about here about in the interview because I mention it at the top of the discussion, but it was such a good chat. But, let's put a pin in that discussion for a moment. I want to encourage you, if you are not a subscriber to this podcast, like if you just, you know, randomly pick and choose episodes to listen to, please subscribe to the show. It actually helps the show's rankings. It just helps the show in general. So subscribe to this thing. Don't just randomly download stuff when you remember. Subscribe it. All the new episodes will come directly into your podcast catcher of choice, and it helps the show, okay? I know I do that. I basically subscribe to every single podcast that I listen to on a semi-regular basis, even if I don't actually listen to that particular episode. So subscribe, please. I also want to tell you about Rockabilia.com, our great merch partners, because they have so much amazing stuff. I actually want to visit Minneapolis, where they are located, because I've been told from a few friends that their warehouse is unbelievable. Just stocked to the gills. Ready to ship you out merch. Use the code PCJabberJaw. That will get you 10% off your order. And I love them so much. They have everything you possibly could imagine from a band merch perspective. They got beanies. They got hats. They got long sleeves. They got banners. They got posters. Anything you want, they have. Fast shipping. I love them so much. Thank you, Rockabilia, for your continued support of this very show. So What do I want to tell you more about? I don't want to. I just want to talk about Lex now, okay? So Lex is the vocalist for Daughters. And for those of you that listen to the year-end episode, know that I wasn't really a fan of the record. Or like I didn't really know how to access the enjoyment of the record. And then our friend of the show and very good friend of mine, Jeremy Bolm, was like, dude, just skip the first song and then you'll totally unlock it. And I did. And I love the record so much. I'm actually seeing Daughters in probably about a couple weeks when they come through Los Angeles again. And this record, their new record, is so, so good. We'll play a little song from it in between my intro and the discussion with Lex, but just so good. And here he is, okay? That's what we're doing. Lex, thank you very much for coming on the show. And I'll talk to you at the end of the episode because I have a fun episode next week that I want to tell you about. So here's Lex.
I was aware of As the Sun Sets, and like I said, we played together before, but the moment that the news filtered out about Daughter's existence, and I mail ordered the 7-inch City of Hell. That was the label that put it out, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I was just like, so hyped up on it, ordered the, super limited pink vinyl, and I was, really excited, and was like, man, this is so good. And the thing that I wanted to ask you it's probably difficult to reflect on, but that was like, right at the kind of infancy of the, internet being a thing within independent music, as far as, mail order, because I remember, I think I had to, send $6 like through the post or whatever. But, there was a palpable sense of like the, excitement or anticipation of, the release of that 7-inch and you guys kind of coming on the scene. Did you find it interesting that like people were, excited for your next sort of musical project, or was that something that was just completely like lost on you? And you're like, dude, I'm just playing in bands.
I wasn't aware of the internet, but it was beyond me at the time. Cause I didn't have a computer. I didn't have even an iPhone until like a few years ago. Like right. my buddy like got me an iPhone cause I didn't have a computer, and he would bought an iPhone for me. We're on the same plan. I was on like his family plan because I'm such a fucking child, right? That I can't even have my own phone plan. I'm like my friend with his wife, and I'm on their family plan. So he just like got the iPhone and could have flipped phone. He brought it over. And so that shit was beyond me. So the fact that people were talking about us, and I had I would hear things, right? You'd hear, like there was a post when As the Sunset broke up that like the most upsetting breakups of the year. And it was like the same year Botch broke up. And number one was Botch. Maybe this was on like early Lamb Goat or something. If Lamb Goat existed at the time, I don't recall.
Right.
And then we were number two and we just thought, why are we number two? No one gives a shit. We've been touring. We're putting out a record. No one gives, no one cares. No one's coming to see us play. But from As the Sunset, we were featured in alternative press. They were doing a bands, you know, I don't know if they still do it, but they did the bands, 100 bands you should know.
Oh yeah. Right. Yep.
And we were on tour as Daughters was on tour. We were doing a winter tour and it was Christmas or something. We were staying with a friend in Texas. We had a couple days off because we are so fucking so dense, right? We're not making any money. We're a bunch of idiots. So we're touring on Christmas. Like, what are we doing when we're at home?
Right.
We had no idea that this isn't, you shouldn't do that. You should just stay home for a little bit. We just thought, oh, we'll book this tour. We'll just drive around. No big deal. So we had a buddy live in Austin. We stayed with him for a few days, kind of had to take a few days off because of Christmas and all that. But I remember in his house doing this interview, this little, you know, he had a computer, so we had to do the email interview for AP and, you know, mention bands we like and bullshit like that. And there was a little feature in there. And we were in there with, it was like The Used and Minus the Bear. I found the magazine recently because we've moved a few times over the past couple of years and they had the magazine around in my office, you know, and I had all these old clippings and, you know, issues of this and that and the other. And I found that and was kind of flipping through it and saw that and looked at the other bands. And it was kind of funny to see all the bands that were, you know, check out these new bands for next year. And it was always pretty popular. It's like, wow, that was an interesting year for bands. I don't really remember, but, you know, Minus the Bear was in there and The Used and maybe From First to Last. There's like all these fucking stupid bands.
Well, you felt to your point, it definitely felt like, especially in those lists, that you had this genre specific thing where it's like, okay, we need at least five bands to fall in the, you know, noise art rock category, and we need 10 bands to be the Warped Tour band or whatever, you know. I understand what you're saying though.
Yeah.
It's a random smattering.
So we didn't know how the attention got to us or how people found us, because seemingly no one was able to find us when we were actively playing and recording and all that. And you know, we only did the 7-inch because we needed something to sell. Basically, the first Daughters tour was supposed to be an As the Sunset tour, and As the Sunset broke up. And we did a tour with the examination of a band from Sioux Falls.
South Dakota, great band.
Outstanding band. And just nobody knows who they are, and which isn't a surprise. I mean, I think Hawthorne Street put their stuff out like very early. Hawthorne Street, it's kind of obscure label time. And, you know, we played, and it was basements and VFWs and all kinds of bullshit, and which is what touring is, or was at the time. So, you know, we were kind of going through the motions of still sort of being in As the Sunset, maybe to some extent, but we had a handful of songs. We recorded them to put out a 7-inch just to have something to sell while we were out, because obviously we couldn't take the As the Sunset catalog with us, and sort of scrambled and recorded real quick and put it out. Our buddy of ours, Brian and Ryan, two good friends of ours, kind of started the label in an effort to have a release or to release our record, and thought, like, well, this will be our first release. And, you know, this is easy. Well, these are our friends and we can just work together real quick. And, you know, because as I said, like, no one fucking knew who we were or really seemed to care in As the Sunset. So we didn't think that anything was going to come with the Daughters. We were just going to keep playing and see where it goes. So thankfully we had friends that were going to start a label to put out our record, you know. Thankfully, yeah, we had a tour that was already booked so we could tour, because no one
seemed to care. Right. I'd say, to interrupt your train of thought, I love the idea. Yeah. Like, I did not know that I knew the transition between both the bands was, you know, like relatively quick, but I was not aware that it was like you had something already booked and it was like, all right, well, we got to change the name and obviously we got to, you know, get something out under the, like, I just didn't know it was that seamless.
We started Daughters, like on As the Sunset's tour, basically, or at the end of the tour.
Right.
So the final Out of Sunset tour was, we'd gone down to Florida and we had that 7744 album coming out that was to be released by,
Undecided, right?
Undecided Records, yeah. Right. Undecided out of Florida. They did a handful of releases. They did Super Machinery, which was like Jake and maybe somebody from Deltonic, Jake from Converge and, would they put out Eiffel?
Yeah, they put out Eiffel. They also put, I think they put out the, or they re-released the first Poison the Well EP. It was kind of their biggest release or whatever.
Right, which was a re-release, right?
Yeah.
So they didn't really have any bands. But we got them and had a really terrible experience. They didn't seem to give a shit about us. And we're sort of critiquing the way we were performing. And, you know, our guitar player one was, he got really, really drunk and kind of like threatened to break someone's nose, and we had another guitar player who wouldn't show up at practice, and he was all like, "Can my mom's sick, I gotta stay home with my mom," and then we like drive by his girlfriend, he's like cars at his girlfriend's house. I said, "Motherfucker, you're hanging," like, so we kind of found we had these people that weren't dedicated, and we went on tour. We had an unpleasant experience with the record label, and although the shows were okay, we just thought, there are three of us here that are very serious. We're the primary songwriters. We have two guys in this band that are kind of half-assing in and not really interested in what we're doing. We stopped at a gas station and maybe someone like the Carolinas, one of the two Carolinas or the Virginias or whatever it was. And Jeremy and myself, Jeremy was a bass player in Anderson Sets and John was a drummer. I said, we're going to break it. This is, we're all done. We're going to start a new band. We get home. Jeremy was going to do a noise project with a guy. He was going to call it Daughters. And I said, Jeremy, don't use that name because that's a really cool name.
Yeah.
we're going to take that name, start a new band, the three of us. We can find two other people to play. Jeremy will start playing guitar. And we can, like, we're the three songwriters. We're this band. We're going to start a new band and it will be seamless, right? I mean, we're the three doing the work. It won't be any different. Should be easy peasy.
Right.
So the transition was super simple. It was kind of difficult to, you know, on a personal level to break up. You know, we'd all been playing together for several years and, I was good friends with, one of the guitar players. We had known each other since, high school and junior high or whatever it was. And, you know, we worked close together. We used to install appliances for Sears and Best Buy, all through the shittier Boston region, Jamaica Plain and all these like terrible neighborhoods. It was a fun job and he was a good guy and we got along well, but when it came to music, he just kind of wasn't, he was doing it to do it. And we really wanted to do, we wanted to go out and tour and while we did that, we wanted to function and not dysfunction. So to have him out, like throwing shit and getting too drunk to stand up and start, which is ironic because that's eventually what I started doing.
Right. But, you took a few pointers.
Right. But I mean, with this story, we were in a van, together. We didn't know that we thought that was like, hey, we're all in this together, man. We're brothers and we're touring and it's all one. And then it was like, get a little bit of attention and all the drugs are free and you just kind of go, oh, I can't stand up anymore. But, so the time was, so I guess, suppose the time was really great and, it was familial. Like we were very close, in the beginning and then on the first tour and, because, we were dumb and we were just playing music and
you were just
we didn't know if anyone cared. It,
right.
It didn't
you were just
seem
reacting.
Like anyone should, right?
But, yeah.
So we just kept doing it because we're like, oh, we're having a lot of fun. We're meeting really nice people and going all over the country. And this is really cool. And kind of people don't really care, but they seem to care a little bit more than they used to. And then, then we kind of stumbled into that alternative press wanted to do something and we started doing interviews and
it felt like momentum. Ooh. I understand completely.
Yeah. It felt like something was kind of was finally clicking and
there
was an interest.
Right, for sure.
Which was nice. And because who knows if we could have gotten there before. I mean, supposedly we could have, right? Essentially, the Daughters was kind of a continuation of As a Sunset. So we could have gotten to where we were in the beginning stages because that was like quite possibly the next step from the last two As a Sunset's recordings, which was essentially the Daughter 7th. They're very similar, although a bit, you know, a bit different, but still has a similar vibe to it.
Yeah, no, I totally.
Yeah, I mean, it was a progression. You can see, like, you know, I always tell people, you can look at the progression from R7H to the record now, and if you go from A to Z, it doesn't make any sense. But if you look at the catalog, you see the progression. And I think if I was going to be honest with myself and with anybody, and I suppose I'm going to be honest with you right now, but that you could even step back into the last couple of recordings that has been set did, and you can see, you could almost include that progression. I mean, it's a different band.
But you see the seeds. Yeah, it totally, you know,
right.
I agree. It totally makes sense. You see the threads that you can pull on and expand on, and, you know, only through perspective and age are you able to be like, oh, like, yes, like I can see where we play our instruments a little bit better, yeah, or whatever. But
yeah.
I wanted to focus on you as an individual, where, you know, you were born and raised in Providence, correct?
No, I moved to Providence in 1998.
Oh, okay.
I grew up all over Massachusetts. Was born in Bridgewater. I lived kind of east west Bridgewater. Lived in Brockton. I lived on Cape Cod for several years. Walpole, Norwood, kind of like suburbs of Boston, like outside of Boston. But I spent a good deal of time in, once I was a teenager, my father moved to Walpole. I started hanging out in places like really small towns like Plainville, Massachusetts, and North Attleboro, Massachusetts, that were, you know, just a little hop from Providence, closer to Providence than Boston. So we, in the mid 90s, started going to shows in Providence, because when it was closer and you know, two, it was like a little less intimidating for me personally than Boston was, which was like,
right,
kind of like,
it's a tough town,
you know, bands like Slapshot and like, yeah exactly. Yeah. And right. And I'm like pretty small and lanky, and I weigh like 140 pounds, so what the fuck, so I'm gonna go hang out in Providence where people are not gonna punch you in the face because they just feel like it. So not that that was the vibe, but you know what I mean? My own like insecurities as a young teen. So, you know, we went into Providence, the Lumber Weirdos, and of course it was closer. So, you know, that was we were sort of welcomed into being a Providence band before we were ever a Providence band. And this would be, again, as a Sunsets, we were playing like every weekend, the same fucking venue in Providence, because you could book your own Sunday hardcore shows at this particular venue.
I presume it wasn't the living room, right?
It was the living room.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah.
And you could call up and say, I want this date. And I mean, if you were smart enough, you could like get several in a row if you call them enough in advance, enough in book.
Right.
Or you would get an afternoon, or if they had the afternoon book, you could play Sunday evening, like get up and do kind of two shows, or, you get a book on Thursday, like, and you know, whatever, throwaway date. But we just started playing all the time, in the city, and accidentally playing with bands that were more established in the scene, like in the Providence, in the Rhode Island scene. Bands like, I mean, that I'm going to name, but no one's going to know, bands like At Any Cost and Day After, and there was like a parkour band called Nowhere Fast, and this was like, and a lot of the kind of big-ish bands, like Times Expired and Temperance, like these bands had broken up by the time we got there, so we were suddenly kind of brought into this scene that was kind of rebuilding itself. And, you know, looking back, I'm proud that we were able to be a part of like bringing attention back to hardcore in Rhode Island, or Providence at least,
yeah.
Because Newport was kind of a different scene, even though the fucking state is so small, right?
You'd have two separate scenes.
You could have
state.
A show like you'd yeah. have a show on the west side of the city, and people on the east side are like, "Well, man, I don't know, I got to go all the way to the west side." It was fucking 10 minutes, man. You should you can take the fucking trolley; it'll take you to the other side of town. So, but you know, what are you gonna do? So, you know, it was cool, man. We became a part of the scene, and I think, in my heart, I became like, I'm a Rhode Islander now, even though I was like, you know, 18, whatever, when I moved in there. But, you know, that was the first time I was really home. Like, that was my first real apartment. That was like a lot of firsts for me were there in Providence, and I stayed there for a long time. And I think a lot of it was because I had moved so much growing up that this was a place where I was now old enough and I was able to, because for a couple years before that, I didn't have anywhere to live. I was homeless. I was living on John's couch, his parents' house. You know, I was like sleeping in a park. I was like staying wherever I could once I dropped out of high school. So, I really didn't have anywhere to go. And when I moved in with my girlfriend just outside Rhode Island, just outside Providence rather, in town Johnston, we broke up and I sneaked right into a buddy's apartment and needed a roommate. And then it was like, I'm an adult, you know, I use the term loosely. I'm an adult. I make my own decisions. I'm now fucking in control of where I'm going to live, and I'm staying here. I'm never leaving. And I lived in the same apartment for like almost 8 years on the same shitty, shitty apartment. It fucking crumbled around me in a literal sense, but I stayed there as long as possible. And, cause I finally had control of something in my life. And it was like, I had, you know, somehow become a Rhode Islander in some way. So
yeah, no, that
I always hated admitting like, I'm here, but like, no, I'm kind of from here.
Yeah, well, it's the first time where you put roots down, because, you know, when you, like you said, I've liked the point that you made where it's like you actually have a choice and you have authority. And, you know, a lot of the times, you know, up until you're, you know, 18, 19 years old, you don't feel like you have much authority. And it totally makes sense. And so, and I know that you've mentioned this in other interviews where, you know, you had a tumultuous upbringing as far as like, you know, your parents were never together and you were kind of moving, as you suggested, all around Massachusetts and stuff like that. Are you an only child?
Somewhat. I have a older brother and a sister my father had with his second wife. And 10 or 11 years later, my father and mother had me. They were together very briefly. And then, you know, we separated. No, I never got married or anything. And then maybe like 12 years later, my mother, you know, remarried when I was a kid. And then had like three younger sisters, so it's kind of a 20-year spot on either end where I'm kind of, you know, placed in the middle, half related to
half siblings,
side, half related to everybody on their side. Yeah, so I didn't have siblings growing up like in the house with me. Weekends with my father would, you know, my brother would be there, my sister, my older sister would be there, and you know, we had a very terrible relationship, my sister and I. But also, there's a I don't often mention him because I don't know who he is. There's a brother, my father, and another woman had a child somewhere between my brother and myself, and none of us have ever met him. Nobody knows who he is.
Wow, that's crazy. It could be could be Ray Liotta, because isn't he from Providence? I'm just kidding.
It could be anybody.
Yeah,
it could be. I mean, it could be you. I fucking don't know. Like, I don't know where you fall in the age group. So, like, but I think about that shit all the time. Where it's like. But in all likeliness, I mean, he's got some trait of my father. It didn't get into like a supportive scene, which just sounds so fucking lame to say that like hardcore was a supportive scene for me emotionally. But not that it did a good job, because I'm so fucked up. But, you know, he's anything like my father. He's probably like hanging drywall somewhere and like missing a couple fingers and has a criminal record. So, you know, that's his shit. But I don't know, you know, like I said, nobody knows who he is. We don't know where he is.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like, maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to like get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/Ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/Ray.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Father died, the information's gone with him, so
right,
you know,
yeah,
never know.
You have no idea, it's floating out there,
which is more strange than upsetting or anything. Like, it's just, it's kind of odd, but not, I mean, you know, family, like, who the fuck are they?
Yeah.
People you're forced to share, they're kind of forced into a pen with these people, and
yeah, you gotta figure out,
they're close now.
Yep.
Like, yes,
gotta figure out the rest of your life together.
Yeah, there you go. You're all, it's a commitment now. You're both, it's it. So you'll always be together.
Like, yep.
That, we're all set. We're like kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
That's, but no, there's that guy. I still have a closeness with my older brother. You know, family's a strange thing.
You know, sort of playing armchair psychologist and obviously only knowing you from, you know, whatever, randomly meeting in the past, but then, you know, watching you play and stuff like that. You know, most people would presume that you are the, you know, the quote unquote life of the party. You're the guy that's like, you know, sucking all the air out of the room, you know, maybe in good and bad ways. Were you kind of, you know, is that an accurate portrayal or is that something that obviously, you know, you embody on stage, or do you kind of feel yourself where it's like, oh yeah, like I'm just a pretty chill dude, but you know, I can open myself up in certain situations.
Yeah. I mean, if it calls for it, I'm pretty shy. in, most, group settings, you know, if there's more than four people in, I kind of stop talking. I'm not an alpha male. I don't battle. Like, I don't want to battle for attention in that sense where people are talking. I won't raise my voice to lead a conversation really. That's, and I, you know, I don't know why I'm very, very, I'm a really emotional person and, I have trouble, dealing with people, interacting with people and feeling, you know, connected to people easily. But once I connect people, I kind of, it's just sort of overwhelming. And, so yeah, I got all kinds of weird shit going on, I think people see me on stage and assume that I'm, you know, walking around and like swinging my legs and arms and talking real loud and all that kind of shit. And, you know, that's not it at all. And, you know, the performance isn't in any way like a cathartic experience where like, oh, I can finally be this person I'm not while I'm on stage. I mean, it's just the performance is the performance. And, you know, it's not necessarily reflective of anything I'm feeling inside. I mean, I suppose I'm kind of fucked up and disturbed in some way, and so the performance can be a bit disgusting and unsettling, but I mean it's like a part of my personality, but I don't know. I don't know if anyone can get anything. I think that if someone just sitting and talking to me in a kind of natural setting, they maybe be surprised that I act the way I do when we're playing, and vice versa. You know, if someone just saw us playing, would think that I'm a crazy person, and I don't know, I'm pretty okay. I'm all
right. Right.
Not anything insane. You know, like throw the television through the window or anything like that. I mean,
right.
All right.
Yeah, I know how to handle this.
All my fucked up shit is psychological, internal.
Sure.
Yeah. Right. I'm going to bite your face if we meet or something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Cause most of our mutual friends, are just like, oh yeah, Lex, like, you know, just super chill sweetheart. And it's like, most people, especially in the context of, you know, independent music and the world that we live in, you know that there is a difference between what the person does on stage and obviously who they are. But, you know, most people in the real world would see, you know, you or I perform and be kind of like, dude, why are you yelling into a microphone? Like, you must be psychotic. And it's like, well, I'm broken, but I'm not psychotic. Like, you know,
right. Yeah. There's a, you know, performance is true. When I was young and I didn't, you know, I thought that like performing was very deep. Right. I thought that when I was going to play a show, there was some time in the 90s, and this was a thing that I started doing because other bands did, and I felt like what they were doing, like there was a thing going where bands were playing without shoes on, like Snapcase used to do it, and like they would take their shoes off when they were going to play on stage.
They would have carpets, hopefully. Oh yeah, it's just
well, we sit at the living room and it's just like nails and it was so goddamn stupid. But I was just, you know, I'm 18. I was like, yeah, well, this is what hardcore bands do, and this is cool, and this somehow means something. It means I'm like really connecting to the music and the crowd of the stage or something, like in some absurd notion of mine. So, you know, play with a machine. It's all like my lyrical content and what I was feeling, and was laying it out while we performed, but it was really fraudulent. I didn't realize it at the time. I didn't realize it, but I knew it. You know what I mean? In a sense where I was going through the motions of setting this up and acting this way, but didn't have the ability to step back and kind of get an overview and think like, this is not really you're pretending to be this person. That was sort of my early performance where I maybe was pretending to be somebody for a while. And, you know, over a few years of performing consistently, and I kind of developed my own way of just like of playing on stage or on the floor or wherever we were.
Right. Yeah. You knew you were more comfortable in that environment.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I kind of, I insisted upon this cathartic experience that really wasn't happening for me. It wasn't the occurrence. It wasn't a catharsis in any sense, but I had deemed it to be because that's what I believed it was to be. It was supposed to be this. So I behaved in that manner, or perhaps thought, you know, psychologically that I am letting something go. And I wasn't, you know, I still feel bad and all the shit. And I hear people say like, oh, I perform and I just like save up and all shit going on and I just can get on stage and let it go. And I just think like, God bless you, you know, because the shit that's bugging me is like stuck and it's in me and it's just here and jumping up and down is not going to get it out of me.
Right.
You know, performing is strange. I don't know if we're getting back to that. I love it so much, and it's a, of all the things I do that are music related, to play on stage is my favorite thing. It's the most important thing to me. It's necessary. But does it like ultimately, is it helping me? Is it opening a part of my personality? Am I still acting? Is this like a person I've created? I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe I'll look back in another 10 years, the way I look back now to 10 or 20 years ago, and it will make more sense to me. But sometimes we're all living this moment, and we think we're interpreting it properly, but it's only with the time that you can look back at
perspective. Absolutely.
Yeah, it makes a little more sense. But
as you were kind of, you know, navigating the world as a, you know, teen and kind of, you know, getting introduced to independent music and all that sort of stuff, was there any notion of a quote unquote life plan? Like, you know, where you're like, oh man, I'm going to grow up and be this thing. Or once music kind of took a hold of you, was that all you could focus on?
Yeah. I just thought I was going to play music.
Okay.
And then I didn't know how, or I didn't weigh the practicality against the fucking desire, the fantasy, right? I just thought that this was, well, when I was a kid, I wanted to play hockey. Like, I played hockey every single day. I thought, I'll be a hockey player. I love hockey. This is what I'm going to do. My dad played hockey, like minor league hockey. I'll play hockey. And then I got into drugs and alcohol, and I thought, playing hockey is hard. I'm going to start a band. And I joined a friend's band and a bunch of dudes I got high with, and you know, and started there. I was, you know, 15, and we you know, had practice and then did a lot of cover songs, or almost exclusively, and wrote a handful of songs that were horrendously bad. But you know, but I was doing it, and I thought that, well, this is just the thing I'm going to do, and because I'm just too irresponsible to be a real person. I didn't have a job when I was a kid. You know, my parents didn't really know what to do with me. My mother is very passive, and I think that the more trouble I got into when I was a teenager, the more she sort of withdrew. You know, she had, you know, she had daughters. she had her own little girls, and you know, I wasn't living there anymore. I was sent to live with my father because I was kind of becoming too much to deal with. So, and my father, who you know, was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and just a kind of general bad person, wasn't a good role model. And so there was no control. I was allowed to just do whatever I wanted. There was no one to teach me any kind of responsibility, or I wasn't responsible for anything. I didn't have a paper route or chores or a job. I didn't have responsibilities. I was just getting stoned and drinking and staying out all night. That when I got kicked out of school, it was kind of like, well, fucking, I was wandering around. You know, and of course my father, who was just absolutely no help whatsoever, and then spent a good deal of the time I was living there with him while he was in prison. So there was no one to kind of set me in any direction.
Yeah, so, you're operating off of instinct and childlike so wonder.
Exactly. So the idea that there was like, well, I could be in a band, but then I gotta supplement my life, like what I want to do. Like, I gotta get a job so I can pay. That didn't occur to me. I didn't have anywhere to live. I was just homeless. I was just like, oh, fuck it. I'll just play music, sleep on some couches. I'll date a girl. I can move in with her at some point. Like, then that ultimately happened. So there was just never a moment that it occurred to me that I have to take responsibility for anything that's happening in my life. So the idea of I'm going to play music and that's it, was there was no wrestling involved with the decision to make. It was just like, here I am, I get fucking nothing going on, so music is the only thing I'm doing. And that was it.
Got it.
Yeah.
And so, it makes sense. Like, yeah, when you don't have this, you know, when you don't have either, you know, parental units or, you know, teachers and these other people that, you know, you can kind of directionally look at, where it's like, oh yeah, like, I guess maybe I could do that or whatever, or like, I'm interested in this. And yeah, you're just, you know, you're anchorless and you're floating around. So I get where you're coming from. Something I always found interesting about, you know, Providence and, you know, frankly, all the bands that you've played in from that perspective is that, you know, Providence has always had this really, you know, robust kind of like, you know, noise, art rock, whatever you want to call it, like, you know, very confrontational, music from that perspective. And, you know, and all the bands that you know, As the Sun Sets and Daughters, like, always kind of sat in the middle of these two worlds, where it's like, you know, I don't want to use the word like metalcore because clearly that has negative connotations that are attached to it, but you know, you would kind of sit in between the, you know, whatever noise rock world and then the hardcore world as it is, where you know, most, like, you don't fit in either scene like wholeheartedly. Did as you were navigating those worlds, like, did you always kind of feel that way, where it's like, we're too crazy for a hardcore show, but then we're too, I guess, structured for these other shows or whatever, or am I just reading too much into it?
No, I don't think so. You know, Providence is kind of in a unique place, and the scene there was very unique in the 90s. And you know, I can't tell you how many times we played the living room with Candiria. You know, they were like progressive, you know, metal hardcore bands that were crossing over and that people just really liked. I mean, even you think of Marauder, you think of like just a fucking hard ass hardcore band, but like Marauder's kind of a metal band. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, you know, like, but Master Killer's got some fucking hard ass riffs. Like, that's like a hardcore metal record. That's like a metalcore record by definition, right? It's metal, it's hardcore at the same time. And, you know, we kind of adopted the term, like you could see fucking Overcast on a regular basis. They were always playing. And they were like a little more metal than hardcore, but they were playing with, you know, Hatebreed and Get High and bands like that. So it wasn't a strange thing for us to play like a death metal show in Providence. And then the next weekend, play a show with 25 to Life or like Come and Correct or something like that.
Right, right.
You know, it wasn't weird. And I think that was a really great thing about Providence, is because it's a very small place, but there was a room for all that to coexist, because there was also like an art scene where bands like Lightning Bolt and Men's Recovery Project and Airborne Radar were there. But then there were like, you know, their punk bands like Drop Dead is from Providence, you know, and Drop Dead's a fucking like, a kind of like a seminal type of really fast, like hardcore punk, borderline power violence band. And they've been doing it for, you know, well over 20 years now. And, you know, the city just, there's just a lot packed in. It's like a box of crayons, right? Like everything is represented. It's all coexisting in a pretty small container, shoulder to shoulder. And it's really beautiful. So there was a good deal of crossover, and it never felt awkward to us. And we were excited to meet bands in other places, from New Hampshire, from Vermont, from Connecticut, and book shows and just start bringing people in. You know, I booked a show in Providence, 99 maybe, or maybe 2000. It was, you know, we played, as a census played, Prayer for Cleansing. Dead Eyes Under was a kind of like deathcore band from Connecticut, like kind of like really heavy. And then This Year's Model, I loved This Year's Model. They were from
Long Island, right?
From the Jersey, New York era.
Yeah.
Area. And, do you remember them?
I do remember them. They did, I think they did a split with Brand New, if I'm not mistaken.
They did a split with, yeah, maybe it was Brand New or something like that.
Hot Rod Circuit or something. Label. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It might have been Hot Rod Circuit, actually, I think. Yeah, but that was Neil from, he was in Sons of Abraham.
Yep.
And whom I love. I still love that band, that Termites and Smile.
LP, yeah, Jewish hardcore. Love it.
Right?
Yeah.
Straight edge Jewish hardcore.
Literally like, the only band that exists in that classification.
The only band to do that, to like take on that moniker, created it. Killed it.
Totally.
And like, and it's just, it's its own thing. It should stay its own thing, because it's just like they did it perfectly. And they were just kind of a pop. It was like very, like This Year's Model was a whole kind of, it was about Neil's love for Elvis Costello. And, you know, they were just a pop band. It was such a weird blending of all these different bands at that show. And no one gave a shit, because I was sort of Providence at the time. But you could get away with that kind of stuff. And, it was a lot of fun. You know, we were booking bands like, Piecemeal, like when they got together, and members of that band with Kevin Baker.
Yeah. Hope Con,
Hope Conspiracy.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So Piecemeal was sort of his, I don't know if it was his first band, but it was sort of the band that he kind of broke out in. Our buddy Mark was playing drums. We met Mark Costello, who would eventually be in Bear Your Dead. Whatever the hell else he plays in. He was the drummer for Piecemeal, and maybe somebody else of note was in that band. But you know, band like that, we befriended this band Ukul Demok, who were from.
Oh, dude, I cannot even believe. Like that band was so like being from Southern California, I'm sorry, I have to tangentially tell the story, but you'll find completely entertaining.
Okay.
The, my band Taken, we always used to play Showcase Theater here in Southern California. Anyways, we played this huge show. It was like, you know, Disembodied, Shadows Fall, Shai Hulud, just a huge show. And then, Grimlock and Ukul Demok came on tour, and they hopped on the show like most bands do, obviously.
All right.
We were the band that, you know, the local band band that got added that played basically right before the tour package. So we had Grimlock and Ukla the Mock completely destroy the place, because like both of those bands are just, you know, so heavy. And like Taken was, you know, whatever, kind of melodic hardcore stuff. So like I'm just sitting there watching everybody murder each other and being like, cool. So we're going to go ahead and play after that. And I remember Ukla the Mock because their parents were driving them because they were like 15 years old. And I just, yeah.
They were so young.
You were the only other person like that I think I've ever spoken to that knows who that band is. I love it.
they had a sister band, the band Fault.
Oh yeah.
They were from the same area. It's Fault. So, but I'm kind of steering towards my mention of Fault throughout this long story I'm telling.
I love it.
So, so we met Ukla the Mock. We played a show together in Brockton. That's whoever we had been playing with, and we had kind of wormed our way in there, or like found ourselves. I don't remember who we played with. I think maybe it was a diecast show or something that we got on, because I had booked this kid Joe. He was in a band called Full View, and I booked the show like out of town. I don't remember how we met. I think we played a kind of a random show in John and I, our old band, which was just like a rap core band that was terrible when we were 17 years old. And we played a show in Providence together. Met through that, and then I like booked his band kind of out of town in like Easton, Mass. And he's like, hey, I'm doing a show in Brockton if you want to play, blah, blah, blah. And so we played the show and then kind of came back a second time. No one gave a shit about us the first time, but we came back a second time, and it was kind of a bigger show. Again, I don't remember who was playing, but the people who live in Brockton were like, oh shit, these guys are like kind of hardcore, kind of metal. We're digging this. And they're like doing devil horns and doing like we're metal, we're hardcore guys. We don't really have a lot of experience in metal. This is a lot of fun. So we kind of, became cool for a little while there. So we were playing, and we shouldn't have been, because we fucking were a bunch of like skinny twerps. We should not have been cool with these like fucking hard ass dudes from Brockton, but they were cool with us, and they thought we were all right. So we play a show with Ukla the Mock. We had never heard of them, and you know, stood in the back of the room to watch them. Two singers. I saw this kind of some crazy shit going on, and then they fucking just murdered the place, and it was one of the most incredible things I have ever seen a band do. They were so amazing and terrifying and brilliant and tight, and they changed the way we, like as a Sunset Fleet, they changed the way we played. Like we realized that we thought we were like kind of like, oh, we're kind of like a cool band, we're doing some cool shit, and we're wild. Like we saw that band playing, it was like, we are not doing enough, something has got to change. And it really set forward like an evolution of our way of writing music. And that band just changed us completely, like on the spot. That was it. John and I became obsessed with the band. And
that's so crazy.
Still a band where I'll be like, oh, fucking crazy bands. I saw this crazy show. And I'm like, I saw fucking Ukla the Mock. You don't know who they are, but they are the best band you never saw.
Life Sentence
if
Records.
If you saw
man.
Them, they'd be the best friend you. Yeah, really. Like, yeah, totally. It's like stupid label. What they do? Like,
Excessive Force, Torn Apart. Like, yeah, yeah. More like Born to Fought.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, that fucking that fake joke. Call at the end. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's really stupid. But, good. Yeah. But so through Ukla, we're booking Ukla. We're going to bring this other band with us, our like kind of our sister band, the way like the Stooges had when MT5 were close, right? It was Fault and Ukla. They'd bring Fault with them. And again, Fault, Chris, the singer, was fucking out of his mind. He would do backflips, and he was kind of like a ball of rage, like smashing things. We had played a show. We had hopped on a show in like Western Mass somewhere, or maybe it was East Hampton. I don't remember what the fuck it was. Anyway. It's a little significant. We just got on the show, and it was Fault and 7 Day Curse, and I think like we were going to split a set with Fault, and then I don't remember if we played or not, because Fault played two songs, destroyed the room. Chris started smashing glasses, sliced his hand open like in some like obscene, horrific way, and was bleeding all over the place, and he just had to go right to the hospital. And I think we were just like, wow.
Oh, that's the end
no
of that.
No sense in us playing. It's just like, who is going to give a shit now?
Right.
So, and then maybe 7 Day Curse, you know, tried to play well. Like, you couldn't follow it. And that was the thing with Ukla and Fall. Like, you couldn't follow it. It was hopeless to try to play after those bands because they were just so intense. And like, it was like a monstrous, it was just like, I don't know. You know what I mean? It would be like,
yeah, you just can't. Right.
The energy they brought.
Yeah.
It would be like opening the Fight Night card with like prime Mike Tyson. Like, Mike Tyson is prime. And then you're like, got to do the next fight. You're like, how am I supposed to entertain a crowd after Mike Tyson just like punched a hole in somebody? Now I got to like stick a move or do, you know, who would give a shit? And that was sort of how we felt about it. Like, this band's going to come, they're going to fucking kill everybody. And then we're going to play through our like really shitty, like crate heads and like, all and, like,
of course, your Metal Zone pedals.
Yeah. We're like really rocking, guys. And it was just like, there was no point.
That's super, super funny.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Fault had brought to us the deathcore moniker and labeled themselves as deathcore because they were really heavy. Chris had kind of like a death metal voice. And we were like, oh, I've been doing that kind of death metal shit. Like, we like to think of ourselves as kind of deathcore-ish. And now it's something else entirely, its own genre or whatever. But no one was really using it in the late 90s. So we kind of found ourselves, we liked to call ourselves deathcore, but didn't really push it and it never really caught on, but we were introduced to that term through Fault.
Interesting.
Yeah.
No, that's, I appreciate that lineage. That's funny.
Hey guys, it's Jack O'Brien, co-founder of crack.com. And I host a twice daily news and culture podcast with the funniest person I know, Miles Gray.
What an honor.
Please,
tell them more about how hilarious I am. Don't tell them about my background in politics as a political operative or anything like that. Just keep going on about the funny.
I wasn't going to.
Okay, that's fine.
Guys, you can come get caught up on what is happening without feeling the life drain out of your soul at the Daily Zeitgeist. You can find us on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever fine podcasts are given away for free.
In all your previous interviews, and you know, most people have brought this up, so I'm not going to belabor the point, but
that I'm tangential.
That you are, you've mentioned it earlier where you know you've struggled with substance abuse, and you know, you've had you got introduced to drugs and alcohol pretty early on in your life. you know, was it one of those things where, you know, once you first started to, you know, drink and do drugs and stuff like that, was that just, you know, kind of a function of the sort of, you know, anchorlessness that you were talking about and just being like, oh, these dudes are cool to hang out with and, you know, smoke some weed and get drunk and stuff like that? Was that kind of, or was it boredom or just kind of a mixture of it all?
My friends started doing it. It wasn't well hidden. My father didn't do a good job hiding it while I was growing up. You know, there would be, there were drug dealers hanging out and drugs were just left around the house and no one was hiding. My father was a biker and he hung with a lot of bikers. And so there were a lot of fucked up people around, people sleeping all over the house. And, I have a vivid memory of like a scale, like there are these old scales that you probably see in there's a scene in with Goodfellas or something where Ray Liotta goes to see his girlfriend on the side and she's weighing everything out and you get these old scales, you know, like scale on each side, and we put it right on top of the table. It was kind of big and clunky. And as a kid, it was fun to play with and try to like put stuff on it. But, you know, there would be I remember like a fucking scale, like Coke on the scale, like, and it was just around. So it was kind of like as a kid and I've always been very sensitive and emotional. So it was kind of scary to me, but it didn't seem strange or dangerous, really. It was just something that made me feel a little weird, but it's simultaneously normal. I really don't know how to explain it. Maybe I knew that this was unacceptable because it was not the life I had with my mother. So I was living in two different worlds, right? Where Monday through Friday, I went to school in the morning. My mom worked real hard by herself. And you know, that was life. I didn't swear. I went to bed on time. And then it was like the gloves were off on the weekends and it's like, I didn't have to go to sleep and I had to change my clothes and was going to make me take a bath.
You just ran wild.
Swear and do whatever I want. Cause my dad was just like, you know, unconscious most of the time. So, and there were just people in and out and all over the place. And it was like, you know, all kinds of crazy, awful shit going on.
Right.
So, you know, when I started getting high with my friends, it was just like a thing that I used to do this. This is like what we're doing now. We're at whatever age and someone just got a hold of drugs. Like, so, you know, someone, I get weed if you want to smoke out of this crushed Coke can. Like, yeah, sure. Why not? Like, I don't know. Well, okay.
No one's watching.
Right. And you sort of get the habit, like, well, the liquor cabinet's open, so you drink out of it. There was no, you know, there wasn't like a home. More I sat and thought, like, is this for me? What should I do? I'm scared. I don't know. My friends are doing this. Maybe I should find some new friends. It's just like, all right, we're doing this. Now we're doing this. I'd say that, like, perhaps with my exposure to, like, so heavy narcotics or whatever that were around and saw people real fucked up was a little bit scary. And I think, like, sometimes when I had friends that got, like, into heroin, that's when I was kind of like, yo, this might be going a little too far.
Yeah,
like,
some of you were, hey guys, this
a little
is
too fucked up.
Yeah.
We're like, I mean, a little beyond regulation. Like, I loved doing like LSD as much as I could. I took a lot of LSD. You know, I got stoned all the time. Snort little things here and there, but I never like speed because it made my dick feel really weird. So I didn't get into speeding, didn't do a lot of coke or anything like that, because it just made my body feel terrible. And even now, if I drink too much coffee, I feel fucking awful. I feel like I'm gonna die. Like, yeah. I drink a lot of coffee, I get all fucked up. So these were things that were just around, and some of it just I fell right into, or I fell into it, but just kind of like, you know, walk into it and then, like, no, someone left the door open. Let's just enter the room. So, but again, there were times where, like, there was a door open to a room and I thought, yeah, you guys are like, oh, I'm going to close this door real quick and you guys can do shit in there.
Yeah.
So
There was a voice in your head that was like, okay, like I could, you know, lose myself here, but like, I'm fine in these other areas, but I know my limit, so to speak.
Yeah. You know, and there were moments, and a lot of it was, my dad was so fucked up, right? My brother got real fucked up doing drugs and all that kind of shit. And I really love my brother so much. And seeing him kind of like freak me out and upset me. And I think I like that helped me kind of steer away from like really hard shit to that, at that point. And then, you know, when I was in junior high or maybe my freshman year of high school, I think it was a freshman. And I, you know, some really good friends of mine started hanging out with, these, Nazi skins, in our town, just like despicable, shitty, shitty guys, like started a fucking skinhead Nazi group. You know, we're jumping each other in and all. It's like really corny bullshit. It's like, yo, man, we live in a fucking small town. Like, there's no, like, there aren't any black people here.
Right.
So I don't know what you're fucking, like, going crazy over. So they, you know, they're just getting a lot of dumb shit. And a lot of those guys are, like, selling heroin and, like, doing all the fucked up shit. And it just seems like, yo, I just want to, like, listen to metal and go to practice and play songs and get fucking stoned and maybe trip out and go out into the woods and just like talk about the fucking stars, man, and what it all means. So, but like,
yeah, you had different
shit,
right? You had different, yeah. You had different ambitions. And honestly, I appreciate that the, you know, parsing those two, I guess, motivations, because yeah, people, you know, people sometimes, you know, once they get introduced to, you know, that particular lifestyle, there is one of two doors that you go into. One where it's like, you're like, yeah, I like the drugs and everything, but like this whole, you know, criminal enterprise, like that's pretty exciting too.
Yeah.
Whereas some people like yourself are just like, oh yeah, man, I just like to do these drugs because like, you know, it kind of makes me, you know, feel weird and I think about music differently or whatever.
Yeah. We're having a good time. Like we're having fun.
Yeah.
Like, I can't do anything if I'm like unconscious because it just like shot up all this bullshit. But, you know, it was sort of the nail in the coffin of my view of, heroin and all that shit like that, where they were hanging on these Nazis and these were like good friends of mine. Like one dude I was playing, like he was in my first band. He played guitar in the first band I was in. And he was hanging on these dudes and like one night he didn't go out with them. They all went out. They went out to some party. Something happened, somebody got in a fight or an argument at the party. They all left, went to one of their houses. And it was just like a high school party, like fucking white kids, parents are out of town, got their khakis. These fucking Nazis show up. There's just like an argument. They leave, they come back with bats and knives and fucking kill people. And they all went to prison. Like good friends of mine, like a good buddy of mine, this girl that I was really good friends with, fucking killed these people and had to, and
yeah, went in heavy shit,
went to the state Walpole state prison, you know, in where we live. Like that's some fucking scary shit. And did like 10, 15 years there. Like that's, it was on the news, all fucking Nazis, but what's Nazi group in their town. And it's like, yo, this is unreal. This just like fucked us up. You know, and my buddy who I was playing music with was just like, by chance, didn't hang out that night. Like, didn't go out with him. And he had to like rethink his whole shit,
yeah.
You know, grew his hair back out and stuff. Was just like, yo,
I got to go the other way. Yeah.
I was like, nah, I was with some people who were not okay.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, you're young. You like, and when you're young, you don't know who you are. Right, you have no semblance of where you are in a literal sense of you know, globally, right? Like what it means to be where you are, and on a like ethereal level or something, where like who you are and what it all means or some kind of shit like that. Like we're all floating in the ether or something, or like are we all connected or like in that kind of like spiritual silliness? Not that all spiritualness is silly, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So one compared to the other is like one's tangential, right? And one is like, you know, else world. So, you know, weigh the two against each other and you got to find somewhere in between. But, you know, when you're young and you don't have any concept of the world around you, it's easy to get sucked into something that's right there in front of you because you've never been, you know, you've never been to the other side of the country or you've never, you know, you've never seen the Pacific Ocean or something, or you've never been to a foreign country. You really have never had to tread the language barrier between, I loved when I was working in Boston and we would work in houses, you know, delivering appliances and installing appliances, and you end up somewhere where somebody just like doesn't speak English. And you had to figure out, how do I explain to this person that some issue has come up? How do we handle the language barrier? I fucking love that. It was so fun to like, try to figure out how to interact with people in that sense. So, but when you're in, you have no idea, like that, a difference in like socially, you can't even fathom it for the most part when you have no experience, especially when you live in places, Rentham, Massachusetts, or Plainville, Massachusetts, or little towns like this. So it's easy to get kind of caught in something that seems fun to belong to. Yeah, I'll join your Nazi skinhead group because I don't really know any black people. So fuck it, right? Like we're all like it's fun to belong and be a part of something and have an ideology, right? And that's why people get caught up in religion, right? In the ideology, and I'll say the word mythology of like, oh, it's this and it came from that other thing and it all means this and follow this path because of this is just like fucking deep thing. That shit's kind of fun. That's why people play Dungeons and Dragons and shit, right? Because you follow these rules and guidelines and it's kind of fun to do it. But eventually you gotta put the fucking board, the game back in the fucking box and put it on the shelf and move on with your day. And some people just don't.
Yeah.
Some people don't. And they get stuck there and they think they're a fucking wizard. And I mean in the general sense of like whatever it is you're doing.
Right. Yeah.
Now I'm a stupid, dumbass, piece of shit, Nazi, and now I'm in fucking prison because I just thought I was just because I just stabbed some white guys. I just stabbed a bunch of white kids. Fucking morons.
Right. So, yeah.
It's like Chris craziness, man.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, totally.
Ooh, yeah. I think about this because, you know, I have kids now and I worry about like I didn't listen to my dad. Oh, I mean, I didn't listen to my dad. He's a fucking idiot. But like, you know, any adult would talk to me and be like, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. And I think about now. It's like, well, now I have life experience and I know things. My kid's not going to listen to me. I'm going to be like, oh, drugs are going to fuck you up. You know, and they're like,
yeah, thanks. I'll figure it out.
You're like, no, seriously, if I could show you inside of my brain how drugs will fuck you up. Like,
totally.
Please don't do drugs.
Yes.
It's the most desperate plea for it. Well, you know, if you could.
How old are
stupid shit I've done?
How many kids do you have and how old are they?
So I have two kids. One's will be five in May.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
What month is it right now? January?
Yep.
Yeah. So he'll be five in a couple months. And then, my other boy just turned one, in December.
Nice.
So,
Yeah.
Nice. It's good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice because, you know, you only have to get half the gifts at that point. You just buy some shit for your birthday and you give the other half for Christmas.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
You get screwed out of that. But
That's their fault for being born then.
Yeah. It's fucking, it's his problem. He doesn't have to deal with it, not me.
Totally. There's two last things I want to hit on was the fact that, you know, basically everybody always talks all about your, it's like, oh man, Lex is, you know, kind of going back to what we were saying earlier. He's so crazy on stage, swallowing microphones, spitting on people, you know, urinating, getting arrested and whatever. It's like every piece that's ever been written about you, you know, people always mention that. And usually it's from like, oh, this is a pithy, funny headline or whatever. The thing that I'm interested in is the fact that, you know, there are, you know, when you have those sort of, experiences at a show, it goes one of two ways. One being either, you know, really, really bad where people are just like, what the hell is this guy doing? Like, you know, you're inspiring a reaction and that's cool. But on the flip side, I'm curious, like, I'm sure that there's like a moment or two where, you know, you were, you know, behaving in that sort of manner and it just like, quote unquote, worked. Like people were just loving it. They felt it. You know, do you have any sort of anecdotal moments that you can think of where it's just like, oh man, like I pushed the envelope and the audience followed completely along with what I was going on?
Yeah, it happens. I mean, it happened too well sometimes. Well, I think that's kind of something I do with now.
Right.
Where people say, you know, they'll yell, good naked. You're like, come on. You know, I'll get there if I get there. You know, but
right. Let's be patient. It's just starting.
Yeah. I'm a dad. You don't want to see my dick. All right. It's okay. It's like those days are over. But of course, at the same time, you never know. I might end up naked at some point. Yeah. I mean, there are times where I've just done something that maybe almost went too far. I've done a lot of stupid crazy shit. We were playing with, we were the Locust in 2006 or 2007 maybe. And we were playing somewhere in Chicago and they had a light rig. They had, it wasn't a normal venue. It was like a hall. I don't remember. I think they kind of, they did shows sort of regularly, but it wasn't set up. There wasn't a stage standing that was used on a regular basis. They wouldn't come in. They set the whole rig up and all that kind of shit. And they had a light set up that just was on either side of the stage. It went up and then it crossed sort of like a, you know, 90 degree angles on like a, not an arch, obviously didn't curl, but you know, there it was. And I started hanging, swinging from it. And a guy grabbed the back of my belt, my pants, as I was kind of swinging the crowd. And in my sort of semi-conscious state, I realized that the whole lighting rig was kind of starting to sway and move a little bit. And multiple people had to grab it and kind of steady the whole thing. And it wasn't until after, or even like years later, I thought about that, I was like, well, things are fucking falling over, you know, crazy. But, you know, years later, I started thinking, like, I could have fallen into the crowd. That room was full of people. I could have fucking killed, like, dozens of people had I just climbed up this rig a little further and, like, swung if someone didn't grab a hold of me. And just, you know, and in a sense of, like, thank God that happens, people get hurt, blah, blah, blah. Like, on a deeper sense, it's like, how would I kind of deal with that, the guilt of, like, having killed all these people because I've drunkenly climbed up something I really should not have. And I should blame myself, my own irresponsibility, but at the same time, I'm like, why didn't anyone tell me not to do, like, everyone knew what I was going to do. I'm a fucking idiot. Like, you know, we ask for a long mic cord for a reason, and it's not because I'm going to stay on the stage for very long. So, maybe anticipate that I'm going to climb up something, do something stupid. But you know, John has stories that I don't have because I don't remember them, but you know, I had to put microphones up my ass and you know, we used to have to buy microphones and they'd have to do something disgusting with them. And John would tell sound guys, we'd have to pay sound guys for gear because they would like beat me up. Like really angry sound guys because I had drunkenly stuck something somewhere.
Right.
But I can't think of a time where, because people either love the fucking absurd ridiculousness of what's happening. And I feel like more often than not, people are sort of prepared for that. And
that's true. At this point that, yeah, I mean, this is an extreme example, but it's like, yeah, if a person's going to a Gigi Allen show, like clearly, you know, they know what they should know what they're getting into. And,
yeah. I mean, you're going to see a small dick and someone's going to throw shit at you.
Yep.
These are the two things you need to be prepared for.
Absolutely.
And if you're at a Gigi Allen show and you're saying like, whoa, what's going on? It's like, you're in the fucking wrong place.
But, yes. You have done your homework.
And I think that eventually we kind of got to that point where, we didn't get right there. It was a little more, not necessarily wholesome, but there was a lot of nudity early on. I think that one of the early shows we did, we were playing in Philly and somebody from Relapse Records was at the show. We were told, like, oh, so-and-so from Relapse. And like, I think John maybe talked to him beforehand. We wanted to be on the fucking label. I'm like, we wanted to be on Relapse. That was a cool label. And we were about to start the set and I just got naked. And apparently the guy was just like, it's not for me. And he just wasn't interested and left. And I'm going to shot us in the foot with that one. But yeah, things escalated over time. And I think that the audience kind of were coming with us as that was going on. So as things are a little more out of control, people were a little more prepared for it. I think I don't know how many people had never seen us before and had no idea that something, you know, grotesque was about to occur to their eyeballs. We toured with Pelican. I think we were in maybe fucking Winnipeg or we were somewhere and I had gone, it was a large room and we had no business playing there. And I had gone to the back of the room at a really long cord and I got all the way to the back room where there was a bar and I climbed up on top of a bar. So there were people who were just there to drink at the bar. Didn't give a shit that there was a show. And I stood on their table where they had the drinks and spilled drinks all over these people. And this guy got up with his girlfriend, threw his arms up and he flipped me off and this whole thing. And I thought, this poor son of a bitch. She's just like trying to hang out here and have a good time. And I just like stepped all over his night, and like literally. But at the same time, I was like, "No, fuck you! Like, this is my show, and I'm playing the show."
Yeah, exactly. There's a give and take.
There's a good deal of selfishness, right? Because you'd think this guy would think like, "I hate this shit. This shit. I'm going to stand as far away from the stage as possible." And I still went out and fucking ruined his night. So,
yep. I understand. Understand where you're coming from.
A bit of an asshole at times, but it's not malicious. It's just, I'm just having a time.
Yeah, you're just
sorry.
Just doing you. Yeah,
trying to fucking play a show. I don't know.
Yeah. The last thing I want to hit on was the fact that obviously you released a new LP and that whole record you released, it was
nice.
It's funny because I listened to it and I just didn't like it. I was like, it just didn't do it for me. But then it was funny. Our mutual friend Jeremy Bohm, who was like,
I'm gonna tell you,
yeah,
I'm gonna stop for a moment and say I listened to that episode,
dude. There you go.
Where Jeremy was very excited about it and everyone else went,
but he unlocked the record for me where he was like, yeah, dude, just skip the first song, which I know obviously is an insult to, you know, you and the art that you create. But like literally once I did that, I was like, oh my God. Like, and ever since then, I mean, honestly, that's what prompted this entire conversation to happen, where I was just like, dude, this record absolutely would have been on, you know, my favorite records of last year. I just didn't have that portal in there of like, and I don't know what it is, like, because I now listen to the record as a whole and I understand it more contextually. But I don't know. Anyways, the point I'm trying to make here is, the fact that it still sounds so distinctly Daughters, because, you know, there's all of the members exist in the band. But
right.
As you guys were putting this together, you always have those discussions on, like, you know, are we putting out a record of things that, or the expectation of what Daughters should sound like in 2018? Or is this something that just basically, as you guys started to write, like, that just started to kind of, you know, come out? Because, you know, clearly there's always that conversation that goes on when you're in a band of like, you know, how are we kind of like framing this and like sort of working this? I don't know if that's a consideration you guys had.
Yeah, there were, as far as assembling the record, just the songs, it took a while, and we had a kind of a cache of songs. Like, there were just, you know, a Dropbox filled with songs. And of course, you know, we all live in different parts of the country, so we were kind of working together and through the Dropbox, and then discussing things through emails and text messages, and occasionally we get together in Providence to work on things. But Nick was sampling a lot with film scoring, and I think that he wanted to sort of utilize space, and so we began to do that in some areas. But of course, there are songs like The Reason They Hate Me and other things that were standing out that we all really liked these songs. And it was a matter of putting together and writing and focusing on material that we all really liked, and then later figuring out how it would all go together. So there were a lot of complexities to creating the track listing. Like, that was probably one of the hardest parts of putting the record together. And yeah, listening to the first song, I mean, I had moments where I saw, like, yo, we're asking people to listen for like a minute and a half. Like, it's 90 seconds before this song starts. Like, we're asking a lot from people.
Right.
But you know, with that, I think we understood that because, you know, we did it anyway, and because we knew that ultimately, as far as the record is an entire piece of art, it was important that this was here. And it was very important to me that Guest House was the last song, and we had kind of debated about maybe this song. I said, this has to end this record. Like, this will be the perfect ending for this record. We have to. So there was like just lots of debating, and everybody had ideas, and we were trying to figure out how to make it work. So I think maybe at times, like, that was one of the hardest things we're trying to put the track list together. Because, yeah, as you, a person who had to get through that first song, we had to not be concerned with that we knew that was going to turn people off. But ultimately, in the grand scheme, when we people look back, such as yourself did, when you skipped it, and then someone said, "Well, I'll just get past this part," and you did it, and now you see the whole thing. It was like a whole piece of music. We kind of wanted to get rid, and that's what I pushed with the album title. When I suggested the album title, it just seemed like, let's just call this record, you know, we call it "You Won't Get What You Want." Maybe in some way we'll take the pressure off of ourselves, and maybe foreshadow for people that to not bother coming in with any expectations about what we're going to do. Because how do you come back 8 years later? I mean, how do you not do anything for 8 years?
Yeah.
Then put out a record, and you know, without you know, people thinking like, "Oh man, been gone for 8 years. Something crazy. They're going to do something wild. Like, this is going to be the record." And just thought like, that's fucking crazy. That's just too much to expect from us and to ask of us. So, and it's too much to ask of ourselves. You know, thinking like that and writing under those kind of constraints would not only like damage the process, and we'd end up maybe toning things down and cutting things back. And now, do I think the record should open with 90 seconds of a repetitive drone? Yeah, I think it should.
Yeah.
Now it should. And, you know, there's in the Flammable Man, there's a long noise part, and I can seem like, yo, this is too long. This is like it's going to get annoying to listen to. And then now I look at it and I think, yeah, it's perfect. I mean, it's good. Like,
yeah,
that had to be done.
Yep.
We just had to do that. And perhaps some of it is me trying to, like, you know, soothe myself in some way, that perhaps we made a mistake somewhere. But I like to think that it all paid off and worked out. And, you know, and we, because we can only do so much. Like, we can't expect people to love this record. We can't demand that they do. It's, you know, up to everyone to listen and decide. And I think the most we hope for is that people will give it the chance, even if they have to be prodded, such as yourself.
But, yes, they have. You know, well, I felt like it was one of those things where I was primed to like the record because I had liked all your previous stuff. And it was once I got over that hump, I really obviously enjoyed it. But then the one thing that I also observed, and I promise this is kind of the last thing, it's like the... you know, the not knowing the sort of film composition of your other, you know, band member that, you know, he had been working in that, because to me, this, you know, this weirdly sounds like, you know, something that, you know, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, if they were like, all right, like, we got to make a band for a particular soundtrack. So like, let's do, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know. It's just this weird thing where it's like, it has this texture of that, you know, it could be placed within the context of, you know, film, and there would be like, you know, no questions asked whatsoever. So I just find it interesting, like, hearing you mention that fact, that it's like, oh yes, like that's what you know, a fellow member was doing for a while.
Yeah, I mean, there's a cinematic feel to the whole record. It almost sounds like you could sit and listen to it, but it might belong somewhere else. You know, it might be some like 60-minute art house film or something,
right.
Or maybe this is, you know, sometimes you watch a film and they use a song in there, but they kind of cut the song up. You know what I mean? Like, well, this part's here and it didn't really go here, and they took the chorus out to like push these two little pieces together so that it would fit in the 30 seconds they need it. Sometimes it seems like, oh, here's a song from that scene in the movie, but it's the uncut version. It's expanded and it was actually 6 minutes long. So, you know, I think there are instances like that where the songs behave in kind of a strange way and maybe have this double meaning, or even live this double life where it's a songs record here, but it's also this like scene from some film that this person's spiraled into, you know, through shame and guilt into some sort of insane hole.
Yeah.
It wasn't a decision that we made. I think that this record wasn't.
Yeah.
It was something we were doing, and we didn't necessarily, I don't want to say we made it work, but there was just a lot of shit we liked, and we had to figure out, like, we had to focus on something and say, like, all right, let's give this, like, all the attention it deserves. And then it really like kind of freed Nick to really put a lot into some of these songs.
Yeah.
I'd say that I think this is the best thing we've ever done, and not in a way where like bands get old. Because we like talked about Roger Waters earlier, and you just kind of go, yeah, this is good, but come on, man, Pink Floyd is kind of fucking, it's pretty amazing. And they say, no, the material I'm doing now is really great. But like, I really think that we've done something special for us and for this band.
Yeah.
But, you know, in an egotistical type of way, I think like these are like some crazy, like we're living in sometimes seemingly end times. Like that things are so bad, like how much fucking bad can it really get?
Yep.
And I at times I look at this record and think like, we just wrote the end times record. Like, we just wrote the record for it.
Right,
like, totally. It's fucking like spiraling out of control that is happening like on a political sense and like societal and like it's, I think, reflective of this mood. And so that's like throughout that's in the air that everyone's breathing without intending to do that. And it could be just dumb luck that we did this now, but I think that we did the damn thing.
Yeah. So
I think we did something great, and I have no problem saying that. I think we've made a great, like a great record.
I feel you, man. I agree wholeheartedly.
I'm glad.
Well, Lex, I could probably sit here for another hour, but I think that would be punishing the audience of the podcast. So I appreciate you hanging out, dude. This was super fun, and I did not know your knowledge of really, really, really obscure metallic hardcore went as deep as it did. So that makes me even happier.
Well, I lived it, man.
I know, dude. Shit. I love it. I love it.
Yep, that was Lex. Great, right? The thing that made me so stoked about Lex, among many things, is his just nerdy knowledge about like completely irrelevant like hardcore bands. Because I don't know, it's not something I'm proud of, but I tend to be the person that most people text when they're like, dude, what was this band? They were on some random label. They give me like very little information to work off of, and I'm able to figure it out. That's just the way my brain works. And I could tell Lex that's how his brain works as well. So that's what we got. Loved it. And what do we have next week? We have the best of 2006 with my friends Joey and Jeremy. Man, we did this last year with like our best of 2007. And this one was even better. Not even from like an embarrassing standpoint. We actually, we looked at our list and we were just like, dude, I ride for all these records still. These records are so good. So we will talk about our best of 2006 lists, our top 10, our favorite records of 2006. So hopefully that's a nice nice walk down memory lane for you, or maybe even discovering records that came out back then because you weren't even old enough to listen to music back then. But anyways, that's what we got next week. And until then, please be safe, everybody.
You've been listening to the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, jabberjawmedia.com.
Shh. Hi there, I'm Zach Braff.
And I'm Donald Faison.
We're real life best friends, but we met playing fake life best friends, Turk and JD, on the sitcom Scrubs.
20 years later, we've decided to rewatch the series one episode at a time, and put our memories into a podcast you can listen to at home.
We're going
to
get all our special guest friends like Sarah Chalk, John C. McGinley, Neil Flynn, Judy Reyes.
Show creator Bill Lawrence, editors, writers, and even prop masters will tell us about what inspired the series and how we became a family.
You can listen to the podcast Fake Doctors, Real Friends with Zach and Donald on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.